Greetings and welcome to This Is Revolution. My name is Jean Bagelin, in for Jason Miles, and who's taking a well-earned break, as it were, because, you know, last night was an exciting show. They had Cornel West on, so everybody's taking a well-earned rest. And I am speaking to you today from the past because I am recording this in the afternoon with a very special guest, someone I've wanted to get on the show for a while to address a topic that I think is extremely important for the left to consider and extremely important in general. And that is, of course, the question of the environmental crisis and this ongoing debate about degrowth and whether this is a logical position for the left to take or whether this is merely a cat's paw for austerity politics targeting the poor and working class people of the world. So this is the topic we're going to be tackling today. And the guest for today is the one, the only, Matt Huber, professor of geography at Syracuse University and longtime critic of the degrowth tendency on the left. You have a new article in Jacobin, a relatively new article in Jacobin, where you are tackling this article, if people are interested. It's called The Problem with Degrowth. You'll find the link in the description. And, you know, this is one of sort of a number of interventions that Professor Huber has made into this quite contentious debate, which most recently seems to have been triggered by the banana discussion and the subsequent banana split that occurred on the left. So welcome to This Is Revolution, Professor Huber.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, as I said at the outset, you have been a critic of degrowth in a general sense, although I would note at the beginning of your article, you do, you know, concede some, let's say, second order points to the degrowthers in terms of perhaps some of their policy descriptions, et cetera, some of the needs of society. But you have a kind of metacritique of this phenomenon of degrowth. So as a starting point, how would you describe degrowth as a tendency on the left? I know we have like liberal versions of it, but what is the left-wing version of the degrowth argument?
Yeah, and what I should say is that the article came out of a Twitter thread that was responding to a new issue of the sort of legendary Marxist journal Monthly Review, you know, the first issue published Albert Einstein, What is Socialism? So, or maybe Why Socialism? And anyway, the whole issue is devoted to what they call eco-socialist degrowth and planned degrowth. As you said, I've been a longtime critic of degrowth, and sometimes I wonder why I keep trying to articulate this critique, because it's, but, you know, when socialists and Marxists even are going to basically embrace the banner of degrowth, I feel like kind of compelled to keep trying to carve out a Marxist position that does not embrace this degrowth. So in any event, you know, this sort of version of eco-socialist degrowth, it is, you know, coming from a very correct analysis that we're facing a very serious ecological crisis. And that, you know, the cause of that crisis is capitalism, and that a solution to that crisis would require fundamentally reorienting the economy toward ecological sustainability and meeting human needs. And so the most degrowthers now have really embraced, I would say, a quite non-austerity position that, you know, like the economy should guarantee survival, it should guarantee people's basic needs, whether it be healthcare, housing, energy, these types of things. But because the sort of framework is sort of couched in this idea of degrowth, they do kind of say, yes, we want to do this, but that means because of, you know, the science is saying about like planetary boundaries or the climate crisis, that we can actually restructure the economy in a way to meet human needs, but also reduce aggregate material throughput or reduce energy use in rich countries or sort of, you know, orient the program over some kind of aggregate reduction of production and consumption, which ultimately I think lends itself to a perspective that believes that really the capitalist industrial economy is sort of fully developed and all we really need to do is kind of redistribute the existing productive capacity to kind of meet human needs, solve the ecological crisis, which as I try, and I hope I'm not going off into too many different directions, no. But as I try to articulate in the article, you know, a more standard Marxist position is that capitalism actually really restricts our development of what Marx called the productive forces or of, you know, production generally. It restricts it to what is profitable and what is can, you know, make investors money on the market. And also, you know, the market itself is this sort of constraining, competitive compulsion of forces that really restricts society's productive capacity in all these ways. And actually a more standard Marxist analysis would say that, like, actually it's capitalism and the profit motive and markets that are preventing us from solving the ecological crisis, because preventing us from developing a lot of, you know, new technologies and solutions that really we already know exist, but that they're just not profitable to develop to scale. And so what I try to articulate in the article is that we don't need to subscribe to this degrowth perspective, which is at the core of its politics and demands, sort of says we need some sort of aggregate reductions, but that we should be way more flexible. You know, if we're going to take over the economy, we need to grow some a lot of stuff that, you know, poor people need, the working class needs, and that the environment needs, but we need to degrow bad stuff. And when you talk to degrowthers, they often say, well, yeah, I agree with that. But really what we're talking about is socialism, and that's really about collective democratic control over production. And there's no I don't see any reason to sort of like hinder how we frame that control to sort of already bake into these aggregate reductions. When I think, again, you know, the science on planetary boundaries is a little, you know, it's highly debated by scientists, but we do know, for instance, that there's one planetary boundary that we're coming up against on climate, and it's, you know, we're emitting too much greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But what I try to point out is that the solution to that planetary boundary is not degrowth. It's actually going to require a massive, you know, development of the productive forces to shift us away from fossil fuels, create totally new technology, totally new energy. It's actually going to require a massive increase in production to solve this problem, what some have called kind of industrial revolution. So anyway, you know, each planetary boundary is like a contextual problem that would require sort of transforming a specific way of producing things. And, you know, this sort of aggregate degrowth doesn't make a lot of sense in my opinion.
You know, what you just said reminds me, I mean, I think it was a year ago, maybe even a year and a half ago, we had Zach Exley on, who was who's one of the, you know, kind of minds behind the Green New Deal project, mm-hmm. as I'm sure you were. And, you know, he put it in a very interesting way. He says, to save the environment, we need to build millions of machines to take apart millions of other machines to solve these problems. But I want a little clarification for people out there about when we talk about growth versus degrowth. And, you know, this concept of growth in general, I think people get confused because different tendencies are within politics have different conceptions of what quote unquote growth is. So obviously the metric that is most commonly used today is GDP, right? Yeah. And I think both you and the degrowthers would agree GDP is just not a really good measurement of the question of growth. Absolutely. So the debate that you're having with the degrowthers, can you just elaborate what you mean by growth if we're not talking about GDP?
So, you know, I think the degrowth movement comes out of a reaction to our society, our capitalist society, which is sort of obsessed with growth as measured by GDP. You know, the press will constantly, I think we're getting numbers on our GDP soon, or we just got them. And, you know, like this obsession with, you know, the economy is seen as being healthy if GDP growth is going up. And there's a sort of sense that our economy needs GDP growth in some way. You know, I think this is sort of an obfuscation. You know, the economy under capitalism doesn't need growth in this abstract sense. It needs capital to profit, right? And you need to accumulate that capital into further capital accumulation. And if that's happening, you tend to see GDP growth as this sort of indirect statistical approximation of a healthy capitalist economy. But in my view, sort of because we've got this sort of ideological obsession with GDP growth in our society, the degrowthers call it a kind of growthism, like this sort of ideological fixation on growth, that what degrowth tries to do is sort of like, well, we're going to negate that fixation and say, well, actually what we need is the opposite of that, which is degrowth. And in many ways, as you said, like they are correct that GDP as a measurement of growth does not really measure well society's well-being, certainly does not measure whether or not we're treating the environment particularly well. And we do need to move away from a society that sort of lionizes and worships this measurement of GDP growth. And we need, you know, and people have been doing this for years. You know, there was once when I was growing up called something called the Genuine Progress Indicator, where they tried to develop a new statistical measure that kind of takes into account things that matter a lot more, like education, healthcare, environmental well-being, into these numbers. But what I would say is, you know, as a socialist, you know, obviously if we seize the means of production and had a collective democratic control over the economy, we're not going to measure social well-being through this GDP thing. We're going to institute something like that different measure of progress, whether it's quantitative or not. And again, I don't see any reason why that socialist society should not want some sort of growth of lots of things that society needs. Like you just said, all those machines we need to solve climate change. But also what I point out in the article is like, we actually still live in an incredible situation of poverty for many around the world. You know, nearly about 800 million people on the planet have zero access to electricity. You know, billions of people really suffer from hunger. Billions of people don't have just basic water sanitation services that we take for granted. So, you know, a socialist society would want to deliver that kind of, access to these basic amenities as like a human right. And to me, that would require a tremendous amount of growth of productive investment and infrastructure. And so it's not clear to me why this new socialist society has to embrace this idea that we're going to sort of decrease or reduce in some aggregate way. Socialist growth would be very different than capitalist growth. It would be growth in human freedom and growth in, human potential and growth in democratic control and all this sort of stuff. But what we shouldn't do is let capitalists and capital and capitalism monopolize the notion of growth. You know, we want a society that grows in other qualitatively important ways. And just because capitalism has created this kind of really unhealthy obsession with its own very narrow construction of growth doesn't mean we should throw the baby out with the bathwater, I guess I'd say.
So the issue is the degrowth movement is reacting against this kind of limited notion, this problematic notion of growth, mm-hmm. But they're extrapolating from this critique the idea, and you outline this in your article, that it may not have been the case in Marx's time, but it is the case today that the productive forces have grown to their, you know, fullest capacity. But your contention is the issue is not the productive forces per se, but the way that those forces are deployed. And in fact, it's a fetter on production. So, for example, the example I always think of is like, you know, we had I think a year ago, Dwayne Monroe on talking about, you know, computing power. So much computing power and energy is driven into, like, instead of creating some kind of using that computing power for the good of society, it's all, I don't know, goes into creating the next sex hookup app. You know, like the resources of society are.
Yeah.
So you might, for example, agree that, you know, the under present conditions in the United States, it's basically required that you have a car, right? That you need a car unless you live in a few places. You would say, well, the problem isn't that people want to have a car or not, but that the people are perhaps required to have a car. And if we had alternatives like a good public transport system, people might not want to just have cars, right? People might want to live with it's a burden and a pain in the butt to get your car fixed. So some of the policy things that these degrowthers talk about, that's not what you're critiquing, right?
No, yeah. We agree on, you know, a vision of moving from privatized consumption to collective socialized consumption. And I think transportation is like the sort of easiest example that I think a socialist would, you know, socialists are not just about democratic control, but I think we would aspire as socialists to also, implement kind of rational planning of society, right? And I think anyone that would want to look at society rationally can understand it doesn't make a lot of sense to have everyone sort of spread out and living in these kind of privatized pods and using their own privatized automobiles to get everywhere. That's just like a really horrific waste of resources. It's very great for capital accumulation. You know, it basically organizing life in that way led to probably the biggest boom in capitalist history in the post-war era. But it's not particularly rational from an ecological or social standpoint. You know, it's very alienating, isolating, atomizing. And as you mentioned, can be quite frustrating. I actually have a car right now that's completely, only after 5 years, looks to be completely toast and needs to be probably replaced. And that's like a private nightmare right now that a lot of people have to deal with. And a lot of poor people, when that kind of happens, that it can lead to complete bankruptcy and debt and all sorts of horrors. So organizing society in a rational way, implementing planning would I think we would want to kind of, you know, if we had democratic deliberation and people wanted to have more cars, you know, maybe we would explore that. But I think I would be advocating for more collective public transit and also, you know, public housing and dense cities. I think a lot of ecological analysts now have pointed out that, like, really, if you want to be efficient about resources, you know, cities are really good for that because people live close to one another, they share infrastructure, and so forth. So I think there's a lot of common ground with degrowthers on that kind of vision of public goods and shared efficient ecological planning and all that kind of stuff.
So, you know, the latest kind of flare up in the degrowth wars has been over the bananas. And I do want to talk about the bananas a little bit. What does the banana split on the left tell us? I'm really trying to make the banana split a thing, by the way. That's my good.
I like it. Yeah.
But what does it tell us about this debate? Like, for people who haven't been, you know, following it, you know, some people are saying under socialism, Americans will eat bananas, and other people are saying under socialism, Americans won't eat bananas, will eat some kind of papaya thing. I don't know. But anyway, I mean, like, I bananas I can take or leave. So, you know, whatever. My grandmother, on my mother's side, who was raised under the rationing system in Britain after the First World War, always says, I didn't see a banana until 1962. It's like, okay, Grant, you've told me that before. So, you know, what does the banana debate tell us? Because obviously this is not just about something taking, you know, like reorientating the American economy, but it's, you know, capitalism is a global system. we live in this kind of global state, yes, sovereignty technically exists, but everything is interconnected. Mm. Why did the banana become this issue? What does it tell us about this degrowth debate and how it aligns with other kinds of concerns on the left to do with empire, imperialism, mm-hmm. The exploitation of natural resources in the global south, et cetera, yep. et cetera.
Yeah. So, I'll put a little plug in for my book, which is called Climate Change's Class War, which also includes a quite extensive critique of critique growth. Just keep banging this drum. But in that book, I argue that really degrowth politics comes out of a particular middle professional class or stratum of society that is very educated and becomes very sort of anxious and fixated on this sort of society of consumerism and mass consumption as being the sort of cause of ecological breakdown and ecological crisis. So when you're coming from this kind of position where you're sort of seeing all this mass consumption all around you, and you sort of say, well, this is what's driving the planet to peril. I argue in the book that really what's driving the planet to peril is really capitalist owners of production that are seeking profit, and we shouldn't focus so much on just everyday consumers, like people who do have a car and need to get to work, right, out of necessity. But in any event, it seems to me that these wars or these splits or these degrowth debates that keep on happening ultimately end in this place where we sort of debate, can we have this consumer item or not? Like, I think a couple months ago it was about washing machines. And then before that it was about restaurants. And ultimately the debate sort of lands on this kind of real hyper focus on how this consumer society is ultimately exploitative. And it's, as you said, like rooted in these imperial relations with the global south and all that stuff. And I think bananas are an incredibly useful empirical example of, you know, a highly imperial commodity economy that has furnished, you know, mass consumption goods for workers in places like the United States. Or you could look at, you know, sugar or tea in the UK, like these mm-hmm. these sort of colonial commodities that are rooted in imperial extraction and labor exploitation.
Well, don't tell the British right wingers that tea isn't from England. People were shocked that Yorkshire tea is not actually grown in Yorkshire.
Yeah. So whatever commodity you want to take, I think bananas are a good one. You know, there have been like these ridiculous where U.S. empires organize these coups in Guatemala to just mm-hmm. like depose of socialist regimes. And it's
the man from Del Monte was not just looking for oranges. Yeah. He was shooting leftists.
Yeah.
Or at least paying people to shoot leftists.
Yeah. And like, the United Fruit Company.
Yeah.
It was shown that a lot of people in Congress at the time had stock in the United Fruit Company. And then lo and behold, they organized this coup that protects the interests of the United Fruit Company. So anyway, a lot of the sort of anti-banana people will point out, look how horrific the exploitation is of banana production. But again, whether or not we should be having a debate about what it would look like under global socialism, given our current power and our current political conditions is another issue. But if we are going to have that debate, it's not real. You can't just say, look how terrible production is of this commodity, because I have news for you. Basically, most commodities produced under capitalism are produced under horrific levels of exploitation, including these laptops we're talking on. If you think about the
what do they call it? The artisanal mining taking place in the Congo, which is basically dumping a bunch of children into an open mine.
Yeah.
To this absolute barbarism.
Horrific. And if you go up the supply chain to the factories in China and, you know, what some Marxists would call super exploitation going on there. But then if we're going to imagine a global socialist society, then we have to start to imagine what if banana producers in the global south were actually given fair return for those bananas? And given return in use values, like things actually that can't be grown in tropical regions, for instance, large-scale grain production, but also manufactured goods, or, you know, could we imagine a world in which we actually had like international producers that are coordinating production and trying to determine society's needs? It could be very clear that not just global North workers would want bananas, but everyone on the planet might want some bananas. And then therefore we could figure out a fair way to compensate those banana producers with lots of stuff that they would value and that they might not have access to in tropical regions. So, I'm willing to concede that, again, our goal as socialists is to have a society where we democratically deliberate social needs and what we actually want to produce as a society. Maybe we would decide, well, bananas are just too hard to produce. They do have this tendency to get attacked by blight, which can be a real problem for banana production. And so maybe we decide, you know, we can do without bananas. That's fine. But to kind of the debate sort of polarizes around a certain set of people who really say Americans can't expect bananas anymore. And that's kind of where our politics is, sort of really pointing out that these spoiled, over-consuming Americans, you know, they get too much. And our vision of politics is really to tell those Americans that you're going to have less, essentially, which is really sort of, it's just not fathomable how that orientation, that political orientation, is going to have any success in winning over the masses of American workers who, you know, to be frank, have not been these spoiled over consumers for many decades. They've been subjected to austerity and, you know, declining and stagnant wages and increasing debt and insecurity and, you know, deindustrialization and, you know, our life expectancies going down. So it's to sort of orient your politics around finger wagging around American consumers, what they should or shouldn't have, is not attractive or productive political orientation for us to build upon. So then people that are saying, you know, then it polarizes to the people that say, of course we'll have bananas, we'll have everything and it will be fine. Again, I'm not even saying that. I'm just saying we want a society that democratically deliberates what we need collectively. And maybe it has bananas, maybe it doesn't, but we shouldn't really it's not up to us.
We don't need to
Twitter.
We don't need to priori cancel the banana. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, it does speak to the themes you were tackling in your book, which is about, you know, class war. A couple of days ago, I saw, you know, on Twitter, you have these Just Stop Oil people in the UK, going into the museums, throwing the paint on the old pictures, but more problematically, going into, you know, like just doing protests that just make it a pain in the butt for normal people.
Yes.
To get to work. And you might say, well, you know, strikes do that, but this isn't really a strike. This is just, very sincere people, but it's a bunch of, as I like to call them, Tabithas and Margos, who all went to Cheltenham's Ladies College and who are now like engaging in their 5 years of radicalism before they sell out to the NGO industrial complex. Maybe that's a little bit unfair to them, but you know, it frames the issue in a kind of moralistic way. And you know, I'm not critiquing people having morals, but you know, mm-hmm. we have to be a bit careful when we talk about concepts such as, you know, morality and justice. You know, what is restorative justice? An eye for an eye, right? You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. Sometimes just like a just situation is not necessarily the optimal political solution. Maybe there are a bunch of shitty people around the world who are bad people, but you still need to win those people over. Because I mean, one of the senses I get from degrowth, and I don't want to be unfair to degrowth, is it's part of a broader meta problem with Marxism in the West, in that for many, Marxism has become a way of understanding how terrible the world is, yeah. right? A kind of like, the world is terrible, and Marxism will explain this for me, rather than a program of political action. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if I could say one more thing, I shouldn't bring it back up, but I really think socialists should commit to a program that says under socialism, you won't be hungry, right? You will not lack for food, but we don't have to we don't have to ahead of time determine what food that will be or what food you're guaranteed. You know, that's up to deliberative democracy. But
because the market already defines what kind of fruits you can get, what kind of fruits you can't get.
Absolutely.
I mean, like the you know, when I go to the supermarket here in America, I don't get all the same fruits as I get in Britain. I don't get all the same fruits as I would get in Iraq or in Turkey or places where I've traveled. So the market is already deciding rationing things is just according to profitability.
Absolutely. So you make a really good point. I think these types of climate activists, they sort of embrace this very moralistic thing about, you know, planetary emergency, you know, massive extinction, and we need to act, and you know, this art is beautiful, but we're destroying the beautiful planet. You know, it's very, trying to be this sort of deep and powerful message. What they're lacking, which I would say sometimes, not always, but when labor strikes can happen, I think they're most effective when they're able to sort of channel the sympathy of masses of everyday people. Like, for instance, the West Virginia teachers, when they went on strike, really had the whole community and the parents that were really behind them in their demands for sort of more robust investment in education, which is, you know,
railway strikes in Great Britain as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think you're absolutely right that this kind of this sort of Marxism in the West or in the global North that embraces degrowth it kind of comes out of this, the professional class, which I define as people that work kind of in the knowledge economy and are kind of, you know, their whole class formation and project is based upon credentials and sort of getting this credential degree that allows you to sort of work in this sort of, like you said before, NGO complex or academia or
academia is for losers, though.
I know
the real money is unless you like a rock star and get to go to one of those like super universities. Definitely, academia is the suboptimal path for selling out.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, but I know. I'm surrounded by these people, so I know them very well. And to me, it's this, when you come from this like knowledge economy, it's, you're so separated from industrial production and the actual material underpinnings of our society and how stuff actually works. I've been studying and really deeply involved in kind of electricity lately and kind of learning, actually, it's a really complex engineering industrial system. And actually, like the unions and the workers in that system, they know it really well. And they kind of understand like what it would take to not only decarbonize the electric grid, but actually make it, a reliable grid that we could actually count on, which really matters to most working class people to make sure the lights are on. But this sort of professional class or PMC or whatever you want to call it, degrowth perspective kind of comes out of the separation from production, where all they see is like industrial production is just this destructive, unjust system that's just wreaking havoc across the planet. And that's very different from the Marxist theory of social action you suggested above, which is really about if the workers really could seize production, they could transform it towards better ends. And actually, and not just the sort of moralistic rejection of the whole industrial production system in toto, but that actually what we want to do is that understand that like capitalism has actually developed a lot of abundance and technology, but it just restricts that from the masses of people because of this highly exploitative class system. And that if we actually took control of these industrial systems and wielded them and repurpose them towards social ends, we could really, you know, we could abolish poverty, we could create freedom for all, we could do all this great stuff. But that's a very different orientation towards this sort of like, you know, knowledge economy, professional class view of everything that is industrial is bad and exploitative and destructive, and we just need to sort of tear it all down.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, what we're in effect then dealing with is, you know, the way I'm beginning to understand this debate is there is a kind of environmental determinism versus a notion of, you know, the supremacy of politics in solving this crisis. I mean, it's not apples for apples, but I'm reminded of the book, The General Crisis, where you of the 18th century, where, you know, there is an environmental change that takes place. And in Europe and the Middle East, that leads to, you know, huge social violence and destruction. But in Japan, it results in a kind of golden age of stability because there are different political solutions taken. And I, you know, I was very struck by, you know, the thought that, you know, focusing on the issue as being the issue of profit, you know, because capitalism develops technologies, but there'll be technologies that are less profitable than others. Renewable energy is never going to be as profitable as fossil fuels, right?
Exactly.
You know, developing, you know, therapies in medicine where you have to take a pill every day is more profitable than developing a final solution to a particular medical ailment, or it's more profitable to deal with some kind of very rare disease that affects rich people rather than, you know, I mean, this may sound a bit degrowthy, but I often say, like, if we stopped medical progress today and just focused on giving everybody in the world access to, like, all the medical process we have as humanity, probably, like, that would probably be a good use of resources. So, you know, in your conception of a democratic economy, then the issue is not growth, but the allocation of resources. And when it comes specifically to the environment, this will actually, you're kind of saying this requires a lot of quote unquote growth, because we have to, you know, we have to, so you're not, you know, there are, I think they're very rare, but there are some elements on the left who see, you know, climate change as kind of a fabrication, you know, it's just a made up plot, but that's not what you guys are saying.
No. Yeah. It would, like we said before, it would require, you know, a third, or some would call it a fourth industrial revolution, completely restructuring our entire energy system, which is the foundation of any industrial system. And it, and that kind of project is, again, if we were actually to do it, as opposed to what we're doing now, which is just throwing out some like tax credits and hope that capitalists and consumers kind of take them up and then decarbonize the economy that way. But if we were to do some sort of like the New Deal vision of sort of building massive new infrastructure, reindustrializing parts of deindustrialized economies, that type of project would actually really appeal less to the NGO academia complex and more to really like building trades unions, industrial workers that work in electricity, that work in, you know, pipe fitting, welding, you know, people that, you know, build pipelines and transmission lines. And, you know, that is who would be really empowered by that kind of transformation. And unfortunately, we've had an economy that has really empowered mostly the PMC knowledge worker economy for really like half a century, right? And but solving climate change is going to have to re-empower that old industrial economy and really channel a lot of those skills that these workers have but have been completely devalued, and in many cases sort of they've just been, you know, thrown to the side of society, and deindustrialization has kind of created these sort of impoverished hell holes that lo and behold lead to a lot of people, you know, being susceptible to, you know, voting for Trump. And so we really would want an economic vision that focused on growth and infrastructure and jobs and a new kind of vision of kind of prosperity that would appeal to, I think, masses of workers that the left does not have right now, right? That masses of workers that not just in the United States, but all across the world are really shifting to the right because they see a lot of the left is really elitist and kind of looking down their noses at them, whether it's because they eat bananas or whatever. but I've been telling the story that when I was in Denmark, I was hanging out with a bunch of climate justice activists that were really, you know, cosmopolitan people that lived in Copenhagen and kind of all rode their bikes and kind of all they would talk about was like solidarity with the global South and, you know, justice for indigenous peoples and all this kind of stuff. But meanwhile, they had had an election in Denmark that week and it had gone very badly for the left. And Jacobin did some reporting that showed people in the wind industry, right? Industrial workers in the wind industry were basically voting in droves for right-wing parties in Denmark. So these climate justice people are so sort of subsumed in these kind of urban cosmopolitan bubbles that they aren't even aware that they're losing the very industrial workers that are supposed to be the core of this energy transition that we need to focus on. And again, if we're going to win over those workers, it's going to be about growth. It's going to be about jobs, infrastructure, investment, a new kind of rebuilding a new kind of society. So, yeah, I don't think degrowth has much to say to those people.
What do you see as this tendency in the liberal flank of capitalism, the liberal wing of the political class, towards, you know, questions of degrowth and environmental management more generally? One of the issues I guess I would have with degrowth is that although it's coming from a different perspective, it feeds into the kind of Trudeau-Macron notion of tackling the environmental crisis. Mm-hmm. Do you think, I mean, the environmental crisis is like a real crisis that capitalism, mm-hmm. if it survives, will have to find some way to mitigate, deal with, and profit off, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't doubt, for example, the sincerity of, you know, liberals in like their concern for the environment. Do you think capitalism is going to, you know, take the environmental crisis seriously? And do you think degrowth will be repurposed by, you know, capitalist classes to put the burden of addressing the climate crisis precisely on the industrial workers?
Well, the degrowthers would claim, no, this will never happen because they advocate, you know, again, these universal basic services so everyone would have their needs met. But of course, to get there, you have to completely revolutionize the economy. And my point is always like, well, how is this degrowth politics going to actually appeal to the masses of working class to build the political power to actually implement that kind of agenda? But I think your point is really well taken because the European Union Parliament just had a massive conference called Beyond Growth, and they brought a bunch of these degrowth people to give talks. And you know, the European Union is not exactly known for, mass social democratic redistribution of wealth to the working class and the poor. You know, it's known for austerity, right? And so I think there's a danger that maybe not degrowth per se, but we're already seeing that neoliberal politicians are very happy to kind of use the climate crisis or the environmental crisis as an excuse for implementing very austerity-based regressive types of policies. So the classic example is, of course, Macron passing what was called a kind of carbon tax or an answer to climate change that really was regressive and really hit working class people in France, particularly people in the sort of peripheral rural and suburban areas who rely on automobiles. Basically ignited the whole Gilets Jaunes, Yellow Vest uprising. And, you know, these masses of people upright were revolting against what was proposed as a kind of environmental policy. And they said things like politicians care about the end of the world, but we're trying to get to the end of the month, right? Really showing that this kind of neoliberal elite that talks about these abstract problems of the climate and the environment are really disconnected from everyday working class people's sort of struggles to kind of, you know, pay rent, pay utility bills, to just make ends meet. And I think, you know, unfortunately, if a lot of, and again, I cover a lot of this in the book, a lot of the climate liberal sort of technocratic elite has been for decades actually saying that what we need to solve this is carbon taxes or carbon pricing or ways that they would talk about it in these like internalizing the externalities of emissions into the price mechanism. And all of those policies really, really did advocate increasing the prices of energy. And it's amazing to me that so much time was wasted and so much words were written, energy was invested in a policy framework that basically admits to the masses of workers that we're going to raise the price of energy for you. And it's just, it's a gift to the right who can just then tell people, look, these elite liberals want to make your life cost more. They're trying to impose this kind of environmentalist vision to kind of raise the price of energy. And it's sort of very easy for then the right to kind of channel kind of class politics against environmentalism and say, this is, you know, if you want a better life, stick with us and not the environmentalists. So.
Yeah, you know, it certainly does, you know, I think, you know, liberals in particular are often trapped by their own ideology in that, you know, I think, you know, it's not just that they're cynically deploying these policies, but I think, you know, sometimes they think we're going to make the quote unquote hard decisions.
Yes.
And absolutely. Those hard decisions are usually making poor and working class people suffer for the greater good. And you know, when you criticize them, it's like, well, it's a necessity, you know, like, you know, people might not like it, but we are wiser. We aren't bribing people with, you know, politics. We have a kind of pure kind of mm-hmm. bourgeois, like,
yes,
objectivity, and we're implementing these technocratic solutions.
Yes.
Which are basically, you know, the what comes to mind as an analogy is the, you know, when they try to implement the internal market in the NHS or even at universities, when they have an internal market between different offices and departments where people are just, you know, moving money and things around the same thing, where it's like, why would we even bother with that? That's just not making anything more efficient or solving any problems, but it creates an appearance of resolving problems. So
they themselves, like, they like the idea of consuming less energy. They think, well, if the price goes up, people will consume less and that will be more efficient, right? And so they buy into this kind of personal austerity where they try to lower their carbon footprint. They try to, you know, get a hybrid or take public transit or bike or whatever. And so they think, you know, if we actually raise the price of energy, it would push or compel those slovenly masses to kind of get more efficient and get more frugal in their lives and
get on their bikes.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it makes a ton of sense to these sort of liberal professionals, but it's not going to make a lot of sense to people that, you know, have to commute an hour each way to a low wage retail job. And are just really struggling with debt and struggling with, you know, deciding to pay rent or pay for the groceries. And it just makes no sense that you want to raise the cost of my energy more. So anyway, yeah.
I mean, you know, what this makes me think of as well is, you know, we're seeing a lot of these young climate activists, you know, taking these direct actions,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. I just have this vision, and again, maybe it's unfair, it's going to be like the late 60s, so where you had all these like civil rights activists and, you know, feminist activists, you know, fighting against the system for very legitimate reasons, but a whole bunch of them ended up being co-opted into neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. And I kind of have a feeling, a sense that this, let's say, more doomer version of climate activism will in the long term be siphoned, or at least some of these people will be siphoned into the neoliberal political order to provide a kind of new radical gloss to shitty austerity policies. I mean, that's the sense I'm seeing this, you know, these people don't really have a program. They just have a, you know, kind of like stop using and stop killing the planet.
Yes.
And I think that makes them actually extremely susceptible, or at least an element of them, to either, you know, complete depoliticization or in the end incorporation, where they'll be able to find all kinds of justifications for, you know, supporting quite, you know, policies that will make the masses suffer.
Yeah. Yeah. Extinction Rebellion had this, one of their core demands was, and this is when they were like rising into prominence in like 2018, 2019. One of their core demands was to, I think, decarbonize the whole economy by 2025, like go from, you know, an economy that has like 80% powered by fossil fuel to zero in 7 years. And again, they claim that this is what the science is saying, and there's sort of moral righteousness to it. But again, any person that sort of understands these industrial energy systems and what it would actually take to transform them away from carbon-based energy could never imagine we could do that in 7 years, right? It's just sort of fantastical demand that had no relation to the material system in which we live.
It's kind of like the abolish the police discourse in many ways, because, you know, you can have Angela Davis go to Martha Vineyard to talk to people about abolish the police, because abolish the police is never going to happen under capitalism. So, you know, it's like, it's the equivalent of saying we need to end war and have world peace. There's no program to get there. It's, you know, that it's not a bad demand per se. It's not a bad impulse to have, but because it's so radical and divorced from, you know, material and political conditions, because it's utopian, it is completely not a threat to the political order.
Right. Yeah. I joked on Twitter that someone brought up an analogy with the degrowth discourse and defund the police, because similarly, when defund came up, people would say, you know, this seems like it'll be an unpopular slogan. And people would say, but when we say defund, we don't mean defund. We mean fund all this good stuff, right? And it's actually the same thing with degrowthers. When you bring up problems with it, they say, but what we mean is, like, you know, more free time, and we mean like universal basic survey. We need all this good stuff. And the question is why you're sort of draping this positive program in a very negative sounding term. And I sort of joke that we should stop orienting our slogans around the prefix D, anything. Because, you know, maybe there's some good ones. People brought up like decommodification or whatever. But the
defund discourse comes from the right, because it was all about, it was adopting the defund the government discourse.
Yes, yes. That's not a way the left should be centering their slogans on defunding the public sector. Even if even if they had this sort of more robust investment program on the other side of it, which we would agree with, but
even, you know, decommodification isn't offensive, but it's probably not a great word to put in a slogan, right? You know, so, you know, that's the other thing. Well, another thing I wanted to get onto about, because, you know, this is something we've discussed on TI before, is like the nuclear power question. I want to drop the nuclear bomb on you right here. Mm-hmm. We're in the Oppenheimer zone. What's your take on the debates around nuclear energy? Because I've read different things which have made different critiques. The most powerful critique, I think, of nuclear power is that it's actually like quite difficult to get online, and it's like inefficient in certain ways, and there would be better ways to produce power than nuclear power. There's some more like other things I've read, but, you know, I'm not qualified to adjudicate which of these arguments is more correct. What's your take, as somebody who works kind of professionally in this area, about the discussions over what place nuclear power has in addressing the climate crisis?
If you look around the world, that to societies that have actually decarbonized to a significant and massive degree, usually nuclear power is involved. And the people that bring up the slowness of it You know, it's true to some extent, but if you look at the example of France, you know, they built, you know,
well, they bloody loved those power stations in France. Yeah.
And they, you know, they saw a crisis of energy in the 1970s and they just went ahead and built, I forget the number, maybe 50, 60 reactors in about 10 years. And again, if you want to look at an example of public investment, you know, looking at a crisis and just completely reinvesting in a totally new energy system in very rapid fashion, France is a great example. And so they, and people, you know, it's true you can build a solar farm or a wind farm very quickly, but actually connecting those infrastructures to a grid and to transmission systems takes a real long time. And now there's all these delays in building transmission in this country. Some say that will take a decade to just get transmission things off the ground. So actually integrating renewables into the grid takes a lot of time too. So that's kind of a thing I was saying earlier. This whole thing is going to take a lot of time, right? Restructuring an entire industrial energy system is unfortunately going to take a fair amount of time. And this sort of moralistic, we only have till 2030 or 2025 or whatever, is not really looking seriously at the material constraints of our industrial system and how we could actually transform them as rapidly as possible. But in any event, I did write an article with my collaborator, Fred Stafford, for the Socialist Journal Catalyst. And we try to lay out that when it comes to nuclear, it has this use value, which socialists and Marxists like to talk about, that it provides, you know, 24/7 power, zero carbon power, and it takes tiny bits of land to produce tremendous amounts of power. Whereas renewables, you know, I think we want to develop them to the extent we can, but their big use value problem is that they're still, you know, intermittent. Like it's still, unfortunately, and the proponents won't really, they don't like to admit it, but the fact that the sun goes down every day is a real problem. And basically we back it up with fossil fuel gas right now. That's the solution we've found for that. You know, and wind is really great when it's blowing, but you know, it's very variable. I remember reading a Financial Times article that was about 67% of the UK's energy was coming from wind in the middle of December. And I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive. But buried in the article 2 weeks earlier, it was 2%. Right. So you're going from 67 to 2. And that's, you know, when it's at 2, you're really going to need some other sources of power. And that's where nuclear is really a great, reliable, steady 24/7 source of power. Even natural gas power really relies on this kind of just-in-time supply chains with pipelines bringing the gas to be burnt on site, whereas nuclear can keep tremendous amounts of uranium on site because it's so, there's so much power in tiny little pellets of uranium. And so anyway, from a socialist perspective that wants to produce for use value, nuclear just provides a lot of use value. Now, what it doesn't provide is a cheap and market-friendly profits for investors, right? So as we've deregulated and marketized our electricity grid, nuclear has become a loser in those really harsh, competitive, deregulated markets, right? Investors don't want to build these big nuclear plants. They're just,
well, the whole promise of nuclear power was that, you know, and you know, they were saying your energy will be free. Heck, they'll be paying you to take the energy off their hands, right?
Yeah.
And which is not going to be a really profitable enterprise if you're trying to make money.
Yeah. And I mean, I think energy prices are relatively affordable in France. The problem is that it's very expensive to build the power stations, right? And if the government, if the public sector socializes those costs and really socializes that investment, then once you build them, they can provide very reliable and cheap. And by the way, when you have fossil fuel powered plants, you're relying on the volatility of fossil fuel prices. So natural gas prices go up and down. And so there's just this steady, cheap, prices that nuclear can provide once you build them. But the fact is in neoliberal deregulated market, electricity systems, nuclear, not a lot of people wanted to build nuclear, and natural gas plants and renewables were much cheaper to build and could carve out these advantages in these markets. But if we really want a reliable, decarbonized grid, I think we have to acknowledge that nuclear is going to be a big part of the solution. It provides all these useful aspects. It's actually way more, and we don't need to get into it, but we could. It's way safer than is often represented, especially in comparison to the other energy sources we have. So I think, and I know David Griscom is a friend of the show, and he's also been quite a vocal proponent as well lately of nuclear. And we're pretty big minority on the left. There's just a, you know, a whole legacy. Basically, the anti-nuke movement really did come out of the new left in the 1960s and 70s. And, you know, even Bernie Sanders is as anti-nuke as anyone else. And so it's a pretty generational thing. I think we're seeing more younger people who are quite politicized and horrified by the climate crisis are sort of realizing, like, well, geez, we're, you know, this is a pretty good option if we're dealing with this existential crisis. But a lot of the more older new left and a lot of the kind of organized NGO left is just very sort of knee-jerk anti-nuclear. So it's an uphill battle, but I think it's going to have to be a core part. And the other thing I should really point out is that the unions in the electricity sector really love nuclear because it provides lots of steady, good, highly skilled, high wage, unionized jobs. And that's another big contrast with renewables, which is once you build these infrastructures, there's no jobs. They're very temporary. So you can get unions on those construction jobs, but once the jobs are done, it's not like, you know, community building, life sustaining types of jobs that power plants would provide. And so we don't want to provide union jobs in coal-fired power plants, but I think we could provide good union jobs in nuclear plants. And so the unions who I argue should be at the core of this decarbonization politics, they're very pro-nuclear. So it's really just the NGO environmental left that's so anti-nuclear. And I'm not sure they're building the kind of political power we need anyway. So,
well, we are coming up. Well, we've passed the hour. Shame on me for keeping you for so long. But
oh, no problem.
Matt, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on TIR. To the TIR audience, you know, please remember to like, subscribe, leave a comment. We read all the comments. Occasionally, we'll go in there and argue with people in the comments, depending on how we feel. Matt, do you have anything you want to plug? Other than you have your article in Jacobin, I'll put a link for your book as well down in the description. Anything else coming up soon?
Gosh, nothing.
Ready for the new semester?
No, dear God. It's just that once August 1st hits, I get a feeling of dread.
Existential dread of the new semester.
I will. I mentioned it before, but I'll mention again the article in not the most recent issue, but maybe two issues ago in Catalyst called Socialist Politics for the Electricity Grid. Email me for a PDF, but I would really strongly encourage you to subscribe to Catalyst, which I think has an incredible sort of every issue is just chock full of really good strategic assessment of the left and socialism and where we need to go. I would encourage everyone to subscribe to Catalyst and check out that article.
Well, we hope to have you on again in the future, Matt. It's been a real pleasure. I think this was a really helpful and fruitful conversation. You know, it really helped me understand some of the context for these debates, because, you know, I'm reading things, I'm like, these guys kind of agree on some things as well. Yeah. You know, the polarization of the debate actually belies that there's actually quite a bit of common ground that, you know, to work on, which I think is always something that should be emphasized.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So
thanks so much.
Thank you. And as we say on This is Revolution, we are out.